Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A woman I've come to know and admire greatly for her intelligence as well as her background in intelligence when it comes to matters particularly involving, well, propaganda and political correctness and the people who are busy imposing those sorts of things on freedom-loving people to their great detriment. Her name is Stella Morabito. She, in fact, has been in the past an intelligence analyst for the United States government, focused particularly back in the day on Soviet and then Russian politics. These days, though, she is a senior contributor at The Federalist, a terrific online resource, and she has been gracious enough to afford us an opportunity to talk with her for a full hour on roughly the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, the thing that began in earnest, the communist enterprise in the world. It is a delight to have her with us, and I am so looking forward to this conversation. Stella Morabito, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Frank. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. I'm going to get most immediately to your recent piece at The Federalist, a lengthy treatment of how freedom succumbs to communism. But before we do that, just a word of sort of context here, Stella. As you reflect on where we find ourselves today, would you say that the dawn of Soviet communism was a critical sort of kickstarter, I guess to use the current phrase, for some of the most horrific things that have happened in the entire history of humankind and remain to this day an affliction?
Oh, well, absolutely. Communism is really about concentrating all power into the hands of really a tiny little clique. And whenever you get a situation like that, as the late Professor Rommel explained in his book, Death by Government, you know, power kills absolute, power kills absolutely. And same old story, you'd think we'd learn, but it absolutely brought so much misery into the world. What you're dealing with is, you know, an ideology that basically promotes the concentration of power. And obviously, it uses nice little catchphrases like equality and social justice to bring that, to make that happen. But, you know, it's the same dynamic, the same tactics over and over again. And of course, 100 years ago, at the Bolshevik Revolution, that was, that's when the dam burst in bringing this poison into the world. And, you know, we see it even today in Venezuela. Communism often goes just under the name socialism. I mean, you know, you hear about the socialist republics of this and that. And of course, that's how Venezuela, you know, identifies itself. And really, it's about the centralization of power. And the centralization of power is very dangerous. Our founders knew this, and that's why they devised a system that would decentralize power.
Federalism and checks and balances and all of that. Stella, drill down, if you would, for a moment on the phrase that you mentioned a moment ago, collectivism, and how it has, as kind of the central organizing principle of communism, socialism, whatever you want to call these sort of totalitarian programs.
Right. Well, to centralize power, you have to centralize power in order to create any kind of a totalitarian system, whether it's fascism, whatever it calls itself, socialism, fascism, communism, you know, whatever. And you know, the central, how do you centralize power would be the big question. And this is what I tried to address in the series that I wrote for The Federalist, which was not, you know, it's a three-part series on the various phases of how any kind of a free society could succumb to that kind of centralization that, you know, would create that sort of totalitarianism. And it's dangerous because whenever you put all power into the hands of the very few, or even the one, which we often, you know, we see in North Korea under Kim Jong-un and the other Kims, is you end up with, people playing God. I mean, people just picking who, you know, who succeeds, who fails, winners, losers, who lives, who dies. You know, I mean, that's where it ends up. It ends up there all the time.
It's obviously, by definition, abusive. It's even if people are not going to be actually murdered en masse, and tens of millions of them have been under one communist regime or another, everybody else, I guess, apart from a thin layer of the elite, suffers horribly at the hands of these guys. But the collective, as opposed to the individual, I mean, you talked a moment ago about the founders and their desire to prevent this kind of abuse of power and abuse of people. They were all about the individual. They were all about trying to prevent the concentration of power that that puts them in harm's way. And just a word on that, Stella, because I think people, you know, Bernie Sanders admirers, for example, and those of the, oh, I don't know, the Cubans, Che Guevara, the Venezuelans, the Chinese communists, have, I think, no real comprehension of what it means to be subjected to the will of the collective and to give up your rights as well as your identity, really, for all intents and purposes, as an individual. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, it does require the subjugation of the individual as a unique person, as a unique human being worthy of life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. If you look at the individual standing alone, what protects the individual? I mean, identity politics, if you look at political correctness and identity politics, it categorizes people, which, of course, is very, very useful to totalitarians because, you know, you divide and conquer. That's how it's an old tactic for dividing and conquering. Divide people, create animosity, resentment. Lenin did it with a class war. Hitler did it with a race war. I mean, it's all about dividing people by whatever other, you know, whether it's the, you know, all different, whether it's class, race, sex, you know, marital status, whatever. It's all trying to fit people into these little pockets so that they cannot even see themselves, much less one another, as unique human beings that they can be friends with, talk to, have a real conversation with. Everybody has to be packaged, pigeonholed in these kinds of systems. I mean, that is how you consolidate how these, the elites, the power elites who try to run the show, have to prepackage everybody so that they can, you know, put themselves into the vacuum. But when you erase the individual, what does the individual have in the, you know, as a means of protection? I mean, the lone individual doesn't really have, a community in any true sense of the word in any kind of a totalitarian state. I mean, the Bill of Rights is really the one document, in the context of the Constitution, that recognizes and protects the lone individual.
To say nothing of establishing that the rights that individual enjoys are not provided by the state and therefore can't be taken away by the state, but they come from God. This is a fundamentally different view of things, needless to say, than, frankly, not just the communists and the socialists who make a big deal of their atheistic tendencies, but even of, you know, the Sharia supremacists. God does not imbue the individual in Sharia with rights. They are reserved to the Ummah. We have to pause for just a second. Stella Morabito is our guest. We're talking with her about big issues of our time, and we will discuss next her new triptych on propaganda, political correctness, and how freedom ultimately collapses to communism if we're not careful. Right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are spending a full hour talking with a fascinating intellectual analyst, commentator, pundit, I guess, a woman of extraordinary acumen where it comes to the forces that are so much at work in our society that we're probably not as aware they're operating as we need to be, especially to the extent they're operating to the detriment of our freedoms. She is Stella Morabito. She is a senior contributor at The Federalist and has recently written an extraordinary three-part series in The Federalist in which she talks about what happens to freedom, how it ultimately is taken down by communists thanks to techniques like propaganda and political correctness, something that she's focused keenly upon. Stella, tell us a little bit about what propaganda is in the sense that you're using that term.
Okay, well, propaganda, you can find a lot of different definitions of it. I include my own definition, and I can't remember word for word here, but in one of the pieces. And it's just basically the means by which power elites condition people through psychological manipulation to get with the program, to get with an agenda. And political correctness, of course, is, it's a tool of propaganda. What's a little bit different about that is the extent to which it penetrates human relationships. Political correctness, when you experience that fear of saying something that you're afraid somebody else will, take offense or smear you, or, you can't just speak openly about things that are pretty innocent a lot of times because you fear that social rejection that might come with your self-expression. So what political correctness really is doing there is basically meddling in all human relationships, like neighbor to neighbor, coworker to coworker, or, among friends or associates. It's a very anti-friendship, anti-conversation, because once that spiral of silence that's, when you start invoking self-censorship, once the self-censorship takes hold and people are afraid to talk to one another openly, their viewpoint is less and less in public discourse. And of course, it creates the illusion that there is, another viewpoint that's in ascendance or has taken hold. And so it's really a very dangerous propaganda tool that's used to separate people. And when I say separate, I mean separate them just on that very core, basic one-on-one relationship level. And I'm just going to add one more thing there. Václav Havel, who was the Czech president, but before that, a freedom fighter in the Soviet, in Soviet Czechoslovakia, wrote an essay called The Power of the Powerless. And he talked about how the real power of all people really lies in what he called the hidden sphere. That's private life, your one-on-one personal relationships. And I believe that that is really the big prize of power elites, to control all, one-on-one personal relationships. They already have the media, they already have, academia, and they have, all the other outlets of communication, Hollywood and so forth, most of it. And but those are just means to a larger end, which is to capture our one-on-one personal relationships. And you look at the most extreme form of this, like in North Korea, and that's what you have. You have all this social distrust and this, real enforced conformity.
Yeah. Even between parents and their children who've been brainwashed into not trusting each other. Yeah. Stella, let me turn to one of the other terms that you've used, and I know there's a lot of different meanings to this, but give us yours for the term political correctness.
Well, it's actually more of a form of subtle agitation, that comes out of propaganda, where people are basically cowed into self-censoring or worse, pretending they believe something they don't really believe in order to avoid social punishment or gain social rewards. And I believe that's all caused by, the main reason people do that is just out of that primal human fear of being socially rejected and isolated. It's very powerful. Power mongers have learned how to manipulate that fear. And they're doing it all over the place, college campuses, everywhere.
But it really was an instrument of this sort of march through the institutions, wasn't it? It was designed by Mao, I guess, to enforce this kind of conformity and submission, if you will, to the party or the elite or, the people in power at the very least.
Oh, yeah. No, I think Herbert Marcuse was the one who just really got political correctness to take off, in that sense. He was one of the, kind of the Frankfurt School. If you read Michael Walsh's book, The Devil's Pleasure Palace, a lot of that whole critical theory thing is laid out about the march through the institutions. In my pieces, I start by just kind of trying to sketch out six phases that you go through. And the first phase would be laying the groundwork. I'll just mention the others.
Develop each of them in turn. Let's go through them in turn. But start at the beginning.
Well, if we have time for that, that's great. So laying the groundwork is really what we're talking about. That is a means to one of the later phases, which is consolidating takeover of the institutions. But laying the groundwork is, a generational process. It basically is about making sure that as many minds as possible are closed to reason and more influenced by emotion or by propaganda. And so in order to lay that groundwork, there's a lot of things that happen, aside from the mass bureaucracy of life where we have all this polarization and dependency in our society right now. It also happens, especially through the, educational institutions, in which independent thought is basically disabled. And it's disabled through not just educational fads that I believe cultivate ignorance and shun content knowledge, which is so critical to really putting things into context. I mean, if you can't study history or you can't, the realities of history, the events, the things that actually happened, if you can't study history or the classics of literature, you can't really put into context our common humanity, that individuals share a common humanity. And when you can't do that, and you're supposed to be able to do that, that's basically what universities are supposed to be all about. And with a takeover, the opposite has happened, and you see this now in the absolute cult mindset of so many students on campuses, where they've lost the capacity to think independently, to think for themselves. They have this garbage term called critical thinking. I'm sorry, I know that a lot of people like that term, but I've come to personally despise it as something that has been hijacked by the other side.
Well, this is the key point, is the hijacking of terms is very much part of the political correctness and propagandizing, which is, as you've described, I think so well, Stella Morabito, the object and purpose of those who seek to crush freedom. We're going to talk more about all of this with Stella in the next segment, and more importantly, perhaps, how this next couple of stages is evident in our own society as rather far advanced. That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're talking with Stella Morabito, a brilliant analyst of intelligence in a previous incarnation and now of matters involving our freedoms, including the threats posed thereto by propaganda and political correctness. And Stella, you've identified six different sort of phases in the destruction of freedom and the slippery slide into communism or collectivism or any other form of totalitarianism. You've talked a little bit about laying the groundwork. What's the next phase?
Well, the next phase we actually talked a bit about, which is the manufacture of propaganda. And I'll tell you, these phases, there's a lot of overlap. I mean, propaganda is an eternal nuisance and always has been, always will be. But just in terms of the, you know, roughly speaking, that's kind of once you've laid the groundwork, people are more susceptible to the propaganda and less able to discern, you know, fact from fiction. And so it kind of builds on itself. And then, you know, before long, journalists basically become propagandists. You know, transgenderism is just one of the later, incarnations of that attack on, human identity, the way I see it. But it's also on reality and it's meant to be universal, too. I mean, it's an intrusion into everybody's self-identity. I don't mean to get too much into the weeds there, but then the next phase, the third, would be agitating the masses, and we're seeing this more and more as people become so susceptible to the propaganda and the constant saturation of imagery that they get through the media as well as academia, and you get, you know, places like the Southern Poverty Law Center basically picking and choosing who, you know, who is a quote hater and who isn't, and they set themselves up as little gods. And then the fourth stage, the three latter stages, would be the consolidation of the takeover of society's institutions, aside from education and, the military and, politics, all the other institutions. The most important, I believe, are those mediating institutions, which are what actually protect the individual from the abuses of state power. And those mediating institutions, which are being absorbed by the state, that are so important, are the family, the church, and all voluntary and civic associations. And once those are eroded or actually being absorbed by the mass state, people lose that what I call buffer zone of sanctuary protection between themselves and an all-powerful state. So it's a consolidation of the takeover of the institutions. And then that fifth stage is where a lot of people start waking up. They're kind of late, but they start waking up. The enforcement of conformity. It's a very unsettling phase when people say, "Ooh, I had no idea that, for example, you know, same-sex marriage is going to lead to, people being threatened with financial ruin if they don't disavow their faith, or Catholic nuns being threatened for not disavowing their faith, or, you know." And then you find things like echoes of those Maoist-type struggle sessions. You see this in these white privilege workshops. Those are really nothing but a throwback to the communist sessions of criticism and self-criticism. And those were just meant to be like public humiliations, and people are supposed to apologize and recant for crimes that they may or may not have committed. Crimes they didn't really commit. And then you get the surveillance state starts popping up. You get people like the celebrity Lena Dunham basically modeling that by, you know, reporting on Twitter that she overheard people having a private conversation that she considered transphobic. So she complained while she was in the airport to American Airlines about it. I mean, this is really nasty stuff. I mean, this is, where you really have a millennial basically modeling how to be a good snitch, how to be a good member of the surveillance state. And then, of course, I think you start seeing signs of psychiatry being used as a political weapon, as it was in the Soviet Union. And I can get into that later if you want. But then the final solutions phase would be the last phase. And, of course, we're not really there, thank God. But you have to be aware that this is how totalitarian elites operate, is that once the power is consolidated, once they feel that, then they go in for the kill, which is basically to brutally eliminate any perceived enemy. And then, this is where, violence has already kind of been in the previous stage justified, but now it's kind of a, it's a full force kind of final solution sort of thing. It actually gets practiced. It's a very old story, very tragic story. We don't realize it as Americans. We're still kind of, not waking up to the fact that eternal vigilance is really the price of freedom. We, unfortunately have forgotten that.
Well, in part, it goes to the point that you've made, Stella Morabito, about not being historically attuned. If you don't understand how this actually has been put into practice in the past, until it's upon you, you're presumably not going to have a clue. And, Stella, there's so much to talk about here. We're going to run out of time shortly, but I did want to just say I'm so struck by the increasing role being played now by a number of elements of our society in restricting our freedoms, specifically and most immediately, at least, our freedom of speech. And I was at a fascinating conference on this subject on Sunday in Los Angeles, sponsored by the American Freedom Alliance. There was a man you may know, Dr. Robert Epstein, who spoke there. He's a senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. And he talked a bit about how Google and Facebook are now instruments of propaganda, of manipulation, of our awareness of what's going on around us, let alone our understanding of it. And it was chilling, really, to hear that even the most subtle of things, he suggested, for example, that, and I don't have the numbers at my hand, but he was suggesting that where you go to the, on Google, you're searching for something and up pops some suggestions as to other things you might be interested in. And the extent to which those things are insinuating into your consciousness of things that are negative about a topic or a candidate, for example, or things that are positive can have a dramatic impact, he believes, and he's documented through his studies, on your perceptions of them. So, Stella, in the modern age, in the 21st century now, are we seeing totalitarianism glomming onto these new technologies or techniques for accomplishing the kind of crushing of freedom that you've described in your pieces in the Federalist?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, these technologies, they, in addition to being used for really, evil purposes, like, every time I think of these ghoul boys and their toys, it's so unsettling. But because really they pretty much set themselves up as gods. I mean, that's what this whole AI thing and everything else is. They had artificial intelligence and all that. But you're absolutely right. The abuses of these technologies to basically, play with human beings as though you are some kind of a god, and see what you can get them all to do for you, it's very unsettling. No, and it can also just kind of take on a life of its own. These technologies. Daniel Boorstin, who I mentioned in one of my articles, wrote a book called The Image way back in 1962, where he was talking about the dangers of these kind of technologies. He was talking specifically about television back then and how the book is called The Image, A Guide to Pseudo Events in America. And he was talking about pseudo realities being kind of like pushed on us. And this is just through TV.
Compared to what's afoot at the moment. Stella, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want you to finish that. However, Daniel Boorstin is a man I remember fondly as the former Librarian of Congress, a brilliant historian, and his warnings should have been better heeded than they were, else we might not have found ourselves where we are at the moment. Stella, we'll be right back with the great Stella Morabito right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our fourth and final installment of a conversation. Very provocative, very alarming conversation with Stella Morabito of The Federalist. You can find there, among other things, her recent three-part series on how freedom is inexorably crushed by communism in phases. And we've talked a bit about some of those phases, but we were just discussing what the problem now with some of the advanced information technologies, all of which it seems, at least in terms of the gigantic IT companies, are in the hands of leftists. This is now, it would seem, a device for suppressing freedom of speech, for sure, and perhaps moving us rather smartly through the other phases. You had a further thought you wanted to comment on that. Go ahead.
Oh, no, it was just about how Daniel Boorstin, in his book, The Image, Guide to Pseudo-Events in America, you know, he was so prescient. I mean, you know, he had talked about television. This was published in 1962, but he anticipated all that. He said, and what will come after? He basically anticipated social media, and I'm not saying is literally, but he expected all these technologies to just exponentially take off and create more and more of a receding of reality in the minds of Americans. The inability to have actual conversations and deliberate actual thoughts being replaced with emotional images. What's happening with social media is it's though, in order to control people, it's like what the hypnotist does. You know, you put them in a trance first. You know, you create a mental fog, which is what education has done over the past couple generations by eliminating the study of history and the humanities and anything that helps us put into context what's real and you know, our common humanity. So, you know, that's basically, you know, kind of finishes off that thought.
Critically important. And Stella, again, I think that so much of this is now second nature to us. We take the availability of Google or Gmail or Facebook or Twitter as granted as we do breathing oxygen when we, you know, are going through our day. It's not clear that very many of us understand the downside risks, and I appreciate so much your helping us think clearly about them. I did want to take some time in our last few minutes with you, Stella Morabito, to drill down on one particular entity that I've had some pretty bad experience with, I have to say, but a lot of others have as well when it comes to this sort of political warfare against people who, because they love freedom, are standing up against totalitarians of one stripe or another, those who are communists or socialists or Sharia supremacists. We are in the crosshairs as a result, a great many of us, of a group known as the Southern Poverty Law Center. And you recently wrote a piece in The Federalist about 12 ways the SPLC, as it's known, is a scam to profit from hate mongering. And I won't ask you to go through all 12 of these ways, but just give us a flavor of the role that the Southern Poverty Law Center is playing in this, well, our friend Christine Brim calls it unrestricted warfare against freedom of expression. And what can be done about it?
Well, one thing to remember about groups like that, anything totalitarian like that, as the Southern Poverty Law Center obviously is, because anybody who stands against the centralization and the consolidation of power and the abuse of power is in the SPLC's crosshairs, because they are all about the centralization of power. And what totalitarians tend to do, which the SPLC does as well, and this is true for all of the perpetrators of genocide through the 20th century as well, is they project their own intentions onto their perceived opponents. They always project. Kind of like Google. What was the first thing they said, their little motto, don't be evil? I mean, it's always, I don't want to say counterintuitive, but it's always an irony how they always choose terms and little slogans and memes to try to deflect your attention away from what they really intend. And so they are a hate-mongering organization, and a fascist organization has to call itself anti-fascist. And that's what they do. They do it right up front. That should be the dead giveaway, just like the SPLC anti-hate. That should be the dead giveaway. I mean, aren't we all supposed to be anti-hate in a free nation where the individual is valued?
But hate and the assigning of blame for promoting it is a totalitarian technique, as you say, Stella Morabito, it wasn't invented by the SPLC, but they certainly are practicing it with abandon at the moment. And I just wanted to get, this point across that they're doing it not just for political warfare against their opponents and for thereby furthering their efforts to achieve end states that are to their liking and frankly not going to be terribly good for the rest of us, which goes back to, what you were saying about these phases. But in addition, they're profiting from it massively. What's that about?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there were a couple of really interesting pieces. I think Charlotte Allen's piece in the Weekly Standard a couple years ago.
And Carl Zinnmeister at the Philanthropy Today.
Yeah. It's too large. I mean, they have what is called, SPLC has what people have started referring to as poverty palaces. But according to Carl Zinnmeister, who runs Philanthropy Roundtable, its two largest expenses are propaganda operations, creating its annual list of haters, so to speak, and running an effort that pushes something called tolerance education, which is basically a programming. I think of a conditioning and programming of children to get with their program. But the other problem is they have incited real violence. I mean, the guy who tried to massacre the baseball practice of the Republican congressman back in June, Steve Scalise. I mean, he practically killed him. And then, of course, the shooting at the Family Research Center, the guy there was inspired by the hate map and so on.
You say, talk about deflection, dressed up as a poverty fighting organization. Stella, the last time I checked, they had something over $350 million stashed away. And this again, is, I guess, to the point of your piece in The Federalist, grand scam on donors and others, for that matter, in the press and among the readers of the press or listeners to the media. Who are buying into this idea that actually it's purer than the driven snow and it is the authentic arbiter of hate and reliable to the exclusion of anybody else, by the way, to tell us what we can safely hear and what we can safely know and what we can safely do, or else be branded a hater, a racist, a bigot, a white supremacist, whatever. Anyway, Stella, with that parting commentary on the Southern Poverty Law Center, let me just say thank you for taking the time to work through with us this incredibly, incredibly alarming story of what happens to free people if they're not extraordinarily careful. Something that is well to be thinking about on this roughly the 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution and in the face of a great deal of pressure from totalitarians in our time. Thank you for the work you're doing at The Federalist, and come back to us again very soon if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.